actually created. Okay, so to put this in some kind of context, so what we have, so somehow this whole field of quantum information theory is kind of lies up in the middle of three fields. So on the one hand, you have we have basic quantum mechanics, and quantum mechanics deals with microscopic degrees of freedom, the elementary particles. So we know the laws of quantum mechanics, you know? And basically this, we believe that these laws and we can use them to very well understand how individual particles, how they behave, and so it's really about microscopics. At the other side of the spectrum, what we have is statistical physics. Okay, and this is kind of very different. This is about macroscopic properties, and this we also understand quite well, mainly due to kind of concepts like entropy, and so somehow this is also actually what we can observe these things. So the macroscopic properties, and these are the microscopic properties, and in the middle there's this kind of whole range. Mesoscopic physics and kind of all kind of problems that we don't really understand, and that's the field where somehow we are really interested in. Okay, but there's a third kind of very important component in the field of quantum information theory, and that's just information theory, so Shannon information, the kind of concept of entropy. And it's clear that there's both with statistical physics and quantum mechanics and how there's lots of connections. So this information theory is kind of a formalization of what entropy means in terms of it quantifies, it really explains very well what information is, what the concept of a bit, and all these kind of things. And then somehow the whole field of quantum information theory was originally kind of located on somehow more in this direction in the beginning. So what we wanted to do is to look how can we somehow quantize the classical, the Shannon's information theory. How can we understand how much information you can send through a quantum channel if you deal with qubits or quantum systems instead of classical systems. And there's all kind of very interesting ideas that came out of it. Like cryptography was just is one of the kind of main applications of quantum information theory. But somehow I think from the physics point of view the most interesting and surprising result is probably this whole field of error correction. So we have error correction and not just error correction, also of course the whole field of fault tolerance. And what this basically tells us from the physics point of view is that you can preserve coherence even in macroscopic systems. And I think this is a very surprising result, and I don't think this could have anticipated by just saying, okay, you have quantum mechanics, you really have to go through this whole machinery of fault tolerance to understand that this is actually possible. I'm certainly not the right person to explain all these concepts and to explain, but two of the biggest experts are sitting here in front of me. But somehow I think it's very important to realize that it answers a very deep question in physics. It is in principle possible to preserve coherence in macroscopic systems, and that's clear somehow that this has connections with this really goes somehow, this fits nicely in between this quantum mechanics and statistical physics, and basically building on these ideas, I think this whole idea of topological quantum order and all this came to an existence. It was kind of formalized. It was very clear somehow that the main ideas are very, very, very similar. And indeed, if you look at the definition of topological quantum order that Zohar wrote down on the blackboard, I don't know if it's still there. Probably, I don't know. It's probably not there. But somehow what he wrote down was something like psi alpha a. For all local operators, psi beta is a constant times delta alpha beta. If you look at this, for example, this is exactly equivalent to the conditions to have an error correcting code. Okay, so there's this nil-Laflamme conditions, and basically this is equivalent to this. So error correction and this kind of topological quantum order are kind of two equivalent statements, and the only difference is somehow that in this context of topological order, you bring in something like a geometry, some you impose that somehow the qubits lie on some kind of a geometry. There's some basic geometry But for the rest, somehow the whole formalism can be thought over. And I think it would be very useful for many people like to formalize this more, like all this topological quantum, this topologically protected qubits and all these error correcting. Somehow it would be very useful to formalize all this and just write it out in terms of error correcting codes, which is just very easy because all these models, as far as I understand, except the chiral ones, have a very kind of simple explanation in terms of stabilizer codes. So all these models of Xigong Wen, for example. There's something like the quantum doubles, and these are anionic theories, these kind of anionic theories. They can all be realized as ground states of certain spin models that Xigong Wen was studying. And all these spin models turn out to be stabilizer states. And all these stabilizer states are, of course, exactly this fits exactly within this framework of error correction. What is clear is somehow that by thinking about how can we use quantum mechanics to transform or to compute or to send information in a better way or to preserve coherence and all these kind of things, that certainly it's clear that we more and more move to this kind of mesoscopic region, and it's there that there's lots of interest. So and what is central here in this middle part, and this is one of the more fascinating parts in the field of physics is to study this kind of entanglement, the real quantum correlations. What kind of new states of matter can exist there? Because if you have entanglement, you can really get new states of matter, new phases of matter, and we really want to have some kind of better insight into this. So we want to understand what kind of entanglement arises in nature, what kind of states can we create, and so further. So we have these kind of strongly correlated quantum systems, because these are the ones that we are really interested in. These are the ones that exhibit entanglement and all these kind of things. And there is so you have these systems that we can even make them in the lab, and there's some kind of a theory. That there is a theory that describes them, and we would like to test these theories. Okay, so these theories, this is like you have for example, high TC superconductivity. This is a kind of an extremely complicated model, but we don't really, apparently people don't really understand the underlying mechanisms. What is the kind of mechanism that drives this? That somehow you have this superconductivity, and so people come up with effective models like spin systems. In the case of high TC superconductivity, what people really write down is like the simplest possible Hamiltonian that somehow describes a two-dimensional system of electrons, and this is the Hubbard model, and so these are really toy models that are believed somehow to contain the basic physics needed for understanding what is this real actual system in the lab doing, and so you have this, so you have the experiments, then you have the theory, you come up with some kind of an effective description, but then the problem arises. It's very easy to write down this Hamiltonian, but it's extremely hard to get information out of it. So that's always the same problem in quantum mechanics. It's easy to write down the many body, like in quantum chemistry also. You just write down your many body wave function, the Schrödinger equation for n electrons. But how do you actually diagonalize this? So this is it's not just in quantum physics, it's in most kind of branches of physics. It's very easy to write down equations, it's very hard to solve them. So, and this is of course also because of the fact that the dimension of the Hilbert space scales exponentially in the number of particles. But I said classically it's also the case. If you have any kind of bits, it's also exponentially large. So it's not, this is not a purely quantum problem, but certainly one of the quantum problems. And typically, if you're very lucky and you propose some kind of an effective model that supposedly describes your kind of system in the lab, you can solve it exactly. But this is very rare. Typically, you will have to find some kind of way of simulating it, and there's various options. You can do it with statistical methods, like very popular methods for this in many branches of physics is kind of Monte Carlo methods. But it turns out that for fermionic systems and for many spin systems, this doesn't work because you have something like this called the sign problem. Then there's many ad hoc methods. Like if you, like in quantum chemistry, you also have lots of kind of strongly correlated systems. And but still, somehow if you have many electrons and you have some symmetries, and apparently very kind of basically simple methods like Hartree-Fock seem to work extremely well. So this is sufficient for many models. So somehow for the models where there's not much entanglement needed, somehow these methods like Hartree-Fock, which are about mean field, which are basically mean field methods, they work very well, and you're able to describe somehow what is to calculate the binding energy of a molecule and all these things. But in this case, somehow these are the cases where these quantum effects are not very pronounced. It's of course a purely quantum, a molecule will not be able to bind without quantum mechanics, but still you're interested in somehow this entanglement, because this entanglement is what drives quantum computation, what makes somehow quantum computers more powerful than classical computers. It's really this entanglement that makes the quantum world very different from the classical world. So we would like to have some more understanding of what kind of entanglement does actually occur in nature, or what kind of states occur in nature or are created or realized in nature. And okay, so let me. So what you have is for simplicity somehow I will limit myself to looking at spin systems, because these are kind of the simplest toy models that supposedly still exhibit are rich enough to describe many phases of matter and that exhibit strong correlations, but they are still simple, because somehow if you have spin system or fermionic system, they are you have simple qubits, and it's a kind of systems that we in quantum information theory with our limited knowledge can still understand and even grasp. So you have if you have a system of n qubits, such as n spin one halves, you have this kind of Hilbert space that is associated to it, and it's huge. Okay, so it's exponentially large, and as already said this morning, it's basically double exponentially large. And let me somehow briefly recall what that means. So you have this Hilbert space. You have n qubits. The Hilbert space is 2 to the n dimension. But it turns out that this Hilbert space is basically a convenient illusion. Like all these. Take almost every, there's almost nothing in this Hilbert space that is physical. There's no, all the states that actually occur in nature or that you can create with a quantum computer or that somehow, yeah, anyway, that can occur in nature. They live on a very tiny submanifold within that Hilbert space. So the basic question you can ask is, for example, you have this Hilbert space, then following the Haar measure, let me just take a random point in a Hilbert space. You can ask, if I start with all spins up, okay, how long would it take me to go from this kind of, okay, this all spins up is here, and you look for any kind of quantum circuit, you can optimize as much as you want, and you ask, how long would it take me to go from this to somewhere here, such that I have such that I create a state that has a non-exponentially small overlap with this random state in the Hilbert space. And what you can show is that this will always take exponentially long. Okay, so take a random state, and you try to create it with all spins up, and you can use any quantum circuit, as long as you only are somehow limited in to have kind of nearest neighbor or two body interactions. It will take exponentially long to get. As we know, all the interactions in nature are basically local, and so there is no way that if you make the system bigger and bigger, it takes longer and longer to get anywhere. So all the states in nature live on a very tiny submanifold. Even the states that you can create with a quantum computer, they're completely of measure zero. So as I said, Hilbert space is a convenient illusion, but somehow what is possible to somehow parameterize the relevant states? What are the kind of properties of the states that actually occur? And I think a very good definition of what are the kind of states that are physical would be all the states that you can create with a quantum computer in polynomial time. Okay, but let's not talk about quantum computing. You know, let's just talk about these kind of spin systems. So these kind of spin systems, or like the Hubbert model, or the Heisenberg model, and all these kind of things. Like let's try to understand what are the basic properties of the low energy sector of these. Because the really interesting behavior is when you have low temperature and you have these strongly correlations, and you want to understand what are the properties of the low energy states within it. And so it happens that all these states live on a kind of they live in some kind of a manifold. Okay, so a tiny submanifold. How you want to identify this manifold? Okay, and there's various approaches to try to identify what is this manifold. And like in quantum chemistry, for example, in many, many cases, it is enough to look at the manifold of kind of mean field states. So this would be something like this. So it happens that somehow, in probably for all the cases in these molecules where Hartree Fock works very well, it's enough to look at somehow this tiny submanifold of mean field states. And this, it seems that kind of the physical states indeed are very close to something to living in such a submanifold. But of course this is not enough. It's known that Hartree Fock fails for kind of bigger systems and especially for strongly correlated systems or for the Hubbard model for these kind of things. So what you want to do is to identify the kind of more the bigger system. So and if you so how do you approach this problem now from the point of view of quantum information? So we just want to basically identify what are the properties that these low energy states have. Is there some kind of basic properties, some basic properties that we can identify and that characterize these low energy states. So in most of my talk now I will talk about spin systems, but somehow there's a very strong connection between spin systems and fermionic systems. And I think from the physics point of view, the most interesting kind of problems are always about our fermionic, like the Hubbard model and all this. But it turns out that they are very much related. Whenever you have a local Hamiltonian of fermions, you can always map this local Hamiltonian of fermions to an equivalent kind of local Hamiltonian of spins. And the low energy sector of these two models is also is completely equivalent. So there is not, it's not somehow a restriction to only work with spins. This is rich enough also to describe somehow, if you look at spin systems, that's rich enough to describe also fermionic systems. So this is not too surprising if you somehow this fact that you have this mapping between fermions and spins in the light of all this work of, for example, Zhang Wen, when he showed that fermions can be somehow so if you have a system of bosons, that somehow fermions can arise as the low energy quasi particles of the basic excitations of your theory. That's basically how you map fermions to spins, or spins to fermions. Okay, so what are the basic properties that these low energy states have?
Let me clarify one technical thing. So this ball, if they are basically characterizes all possible states.
Yes.
That given the hyperspace can be produced with a quantum computer in polynomial time.
No, this is all states. These are the, let's
right,
say.
No, that's it, the little ball.
Oh, okay.
So you're going to define.
Okay. So let's say this is. It's not known, of course, that we can create with the quantum computer all low. So this was kind of the mean field states. Okay, and then I said, okay, these are all the low energy states of all local Hamiltonians, and these would be, let's say, all the states that we can create with the quantum computer. What we don't know is, of course, if this ball is included in this bigger one. We really don't know anything about this. We don't know. There's no proof.
But that you define mathematically the boundary you are using now.
Yeah, but this kind of picture is completely. So all these balls are of measure zero. Okay, so they're all points.
It's fine, but
this is. And this is a point within that, and this is a point within that point. So it's. Just to give some ideas of how you have all the possible states. But this is way too much. Most of the states in Hilbert space are physical. You will never. There's no way that there's ever any kind of physical state that will evolve somewhere close to that. So this is of course this is not. You don't have to take this picture seriously. It's just to say that somehow the real physical states, they live on a submanifold in Hilbert space. And what you want to do is like you want to identify what is this manifold where the low energy states of local Hamiltonians are living. Okay, so and for this we have to understand what are the properties. Okay, so what you have is let's, let me write down, for example, the Heisenberg Hamiltonian. Okay, so this is kind of the archetypical model. So you have a lattice, and you have spins on the lattice, let's say spin 1/2, and they interact via the Heisenberg model, and you want to find what is the ground state of this Hamiltonian. So this is a kind of an antiferromagnetic interaction. So somehow you see that what you want is basically that all these reduced density operators. So because somehow at the end this is equal to the sum Overall, I trace of the trace. Of S I S J times rho I J. So it's a sum of local terms. So what I'm saying here is completely trivial. This is not equal, but the energy of a certain state with reduced density operators rho I J is just equal to this sum. So what I'm writing down here is that the energy is just completely determined by the local properties. And a ground state of the system is, of course, determined by the fact that it has the minimal possible energy of all states. That means that ground states are characterized by the fact that they have extremal local properties. This is, of course, a very ungeneric thing. So what ground states always have extremal local properties. So they try to and if there's one range entanglement and all these kind of things, this is solely driven by somehow the desire of these ground states to have extremal local properties. And this is a very kind of ungeneric feature. This is very, if you take a random state in Hilbert space, the local, they will not have any local properties. There's no kind of all the correlations will be in the higher order correlations. So this is a very strong restriction. This is one kind of property that they have. The local properties determine the whole. So the long range correlations are really driven by somehow trying to extremize the close range. But somehow there's another problem, because you see that all this is just dependent on local properties. There's something called monogamy of entanglement. Okay? And that means that if you consider this Heisenberg model, you know that this term is always minimized if all these rho ij's are singlets. Okay? Because a singlet minimizes the energy for if you have a Heisenberg interaction between two spins. But if you have a singlet between, let's say, 1 and 2, and you would also like to have a singlet between 2 and 3, and all these and so further, there's competition there. Okay? Because if you have a singlet between 1 and 2, the particle 3 cannot be entangled anymore with 1 and 2. This is because of this kind of monogamy of entanglement. There is if you share somehow entanglement with somebody, you cannot share it anymore with somebody else. And that's a basic property, and you can work out some kind of mathematical formulations of this. And if you have a system of high dimensionality, for example, okay, you can look at like a three-dimensional lattice, and you notice so this system has, of course, there's always a ground state with the same symmetry as the Hamiltonian. Okay, you can take if you have symmetry breaking, you just take the linear combination of this symmetry broken state, that this has the same symmetry as the original Hamiltonian. And therefore, if you have a high dimensional lattice, you know somehow that this rho ij will be, like on a cubic lattice, it's rho 1, 2 will be equal, this reduced density operator will be equal to this one, to this one, and to this one. So all these reduced density operators must be equal to each other. And that means somehow if I share a entanglement with this one, I have to share the same amount with this one and this one. So and because of this competition, because of this monogamy of entanglement, the larger the dimensionality, the less entanglement you can have, okay? Because it's impossible. So that means that's this way you can really justify the use of mean field theory. It can really work out somehow how good will mean field theory give me as a result in this and this and this dimension. And then this is really the reason why in three dimensions, basically, mean field theory always gives you good results, because there's no space in this kind of, that there's no space in Hilbert space to share lots of entanglement with many, many persons. If you're limited to a kind of local dimension, you cannot share much entanglement with the other ones. That somehow shows you that the most interesting physics from the point of view of kind of entanglement will be you will see it in one and two dimensions, okay? Because three dimensions there's already too much. In one dimension you will have the strongest quantum effects, okay? Because you have the least amount of frustration. However, probably the most interesting from the physics point of view is two dimensions, because in one dimension is pretty boring. You don't have topological kind of, you don't have many paths between particles. It's also hard to get. The two dimensions is kind of the most challenging physics, and people are very well aware of that in condensed matter physics. It's the two dimensional systems that are the hardest, where we know the least about it, because there's lots of entanglement. But also you have this kind of topological features, So the third property somehow is very much related to the first one. What you try to do is the ground states have the property that they extremize their local properties. But as a consequence, somehow what happens in all these models that we know, and anyway, this is something that we think is generic, is that the correlations, that connected correlation functions are always decaying pretty fast. So if you have gap models, you can even prove that. So if you have this Hamiltonian and you know that there's a gap, you can even prove that all connected correlation functions decay exponentially. Okay, but even in the case of critical systems where you have long-range correlations, yes?
Do you think it's possible to explain phase starting from this point would be the fact that there is an upper critical dimensionality for which infield becomes gives the right correct exponents, critical exponents.
I've not tried that. So could be possible. So you can certainly bump. You can using this kind of inequality. What you can certainly do is bump the energy somehow. You can say so. You have the exact ground state energy, and you can just say okay, my ground state energy that I will calculate using let's say this Hartree-Fock method or a mean field method will be at most that much off from the real ground state energy. So this you can do using these methods. But if this is enough to calculate explicit, I don't know, maybe yes, maybe that would be very interesting to do, of course. Okay, but the important thing is that correlations are decaying. So that means that somehow, in this desire of extremizing local properties, somehow the long range, it means that you get some kind of locality. And let's see how to. So there are somehow so correlations. If you calculate somehow correlations ki, aj, then typically this goes like say in a critical system this goes like 1/i − j to some power. So this decays also even in critical systems it decays pretty fast. So don't have to. You only have to worry about local problems. So there is somehow a remark that, and this gives rise to a very interesting kind of physics, of course, is that you can also have non-local. You can have, even in gap system, you can have non-local order parameters that don't vanish. Like in this, for example, in one dimension you have the AKLT model, and we should have something called the string order parameter. And this is a many-body operator. It's very much related to, let's say, the kind of order parameters that you see in the Torrey code. So it's something that winds around the torus. It's even in one dimension, you can have these kind of long-range operators that have a non-zero expectation value and that have to do something with topological kind of properties. And it turns out that there's an interesting connection between these things. So whenever you have something like this long-range correlations, that means that these systems, if you would be able to create them in the lab, would be pretty interesting for quantum information processing. Because whenever you have these long-range correlations, it means that somehow there is some kind of long-range entanglement. And this is very interesting in the context of for example, quantum repeaters. So in quantum repeaters, what you try to do is to create entanglement between... So you try to create entanglement between one party and another one very far apart from it. And doing this, what you have is kind of middle station. So what you try to do is build up entanglement first between these two, and then swap the entanglement. But whatever, somehow in an abstract way, you can model all these kind of systems as one big spin system. And if you have one of these non-local order parameters, and typically this is a signature that you will be able to use this system as a perfect quantum repeater. But yeah, I don't have time to get into this. So you have these kind of correlation functions that are decaying exponentially, or falling or power law or exponentially. So you would like to define something like okay, let me instead of polynomial, let me put here exponential because this is the more kind of generic case. You have i − j divided by psi. So you have a correlation map. And so one thing we looked at recently is, for example, what is this really well defined, this correlation? So we are just like trying to understand what does it mean, a correlation? So if all the connected, so what I should have written here is the connected correlation. Okay. Aj. And so if it's decay exponential, is this enough somehow to such that you have a system that long distance this factorizes? Because that's basically what you want to have. The idea is that if correlation function are decaying fast, that means that somehow if you like in one dimension, this would mean that somehow if you only look at if you forget about what is happening here in the middle. So you have system A, you have system B and C, and this block somehow is much longer than the correlation length. What you would like to say is that if you have a decaying correlation like that, this system AB, that you can describe this as a tensor product of row A tensor of B. That somehow they don't talk to each other, that there's a really some kind of notion of locality there. So this is the kind of statement you want to make. This is what it means to have a correlation length. So that means if you are far apart from each other, basically your system factorizes. It turns out that this is not true. So people in quantum information theory have found examples of states that have practically zero kind of connected correlation functions everywhere, but they are very far from product states. Okay, so from a purely mathematical point of view, this is not sufficient. This kind of condition is not enough to somehow infer that your system factorizes. And it turns out that somehow the really right way of looking at the correlation, like all these kind of things, from the mathematical point of view. So not that much talking about some kind of physics, but more the mathematical rigor that people in quantum information theory typically want to see is that somehow you instead of looking at correlation lengths, you should define the notion of a correlation length via the mutual information. Okay, because mutual information is something that is zero if and only if you're close to a tensor product state. So if you have these regions A, C, and B, and the mutual information is defined between these two regions, is defined as S of A, the entropy of A plus the entropy of B minus the entropy of AB. And you know that your system is close to a tensor product if and only if this quantity is close to zero. So if this is smaller than epsilon, then you know somehow that indeed your system will be close to a tensor product. So that somehow.
What kind of example do you find where you have this exponentially gain correlation function and it's not a tensor product?
Yeah, so these states just exist. So these are data hiding states. They're very non-generic. So probably these states indeed live here. Okay, so they're not. We don't know whether they are physical or not. But it's just important to know that they exist. Okay, so it is surprising, you know, that you have states. All the collected correlation functions are basically zero. And still they are very far from tensor product states.
Well, they are exactly zero.
Epsilon. So Debbie, is Debbie here? No, she's, I think, yeah. So you were a part of the co-author, no, that paper?
Zero.
It
would be a
product
state, but the problem is that when you're a little away from zero, then the behavior, like the dependence on how far you're away from zero is very crazy.
But you can make this epsilon as small as you can, as you want. Somehow the system becomes big.
Right, but it's scaling.
The scaling is a dimension dependence on it. So for large dimension, things can be pretty ugly.
Was it not the exponential number of particles,
right,
or
dimension? Yeah.
So proportional to Hilbert space dimension. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Okay. So anyway, this is just a side remark. The main point is that these systems have some kind of a notion of locality, and let me now show that this is so now and based on these kind of notions, what people have been very interested in is somehow what try to quantify now. So we have this concept of mutual information. We have this that quantifies how many correlations do you have. We want to see more. We want to see somehow how many. For example, if you have a two-dimensional lattice, okay, so you have a big two-dimensional lattice, you want to understand how much correlations do I have in a block of space. So you have a big two-dimensional lattice, and you take out this block of space, and this goes to infinity. And you calculate, for example, the entropy of that. So suppose that the global state is in a ground state, and you want to quantify how many correlations do these kind of spins have somehow in the outside. So this is basically another way of looking at the correlation. So if you calculate the entropy of that block, so you have this ground state, and then you trace out all the particles except the ones inside, and you calculate this entropy, okay? This entropy, which is given as minus the trace of rho log rho, rho A log rho A. Somehow, what this picture would somehow suggest the fact that you have a finite correlation length is that this entropy should only kind of scale like the boundary of that block, not as the volume. Because somehow what you think is that the inside of this is completely uncorrelated with the outside. So what you would like to see is that somehow, is it really true that indeed if I trace out this kind of out, that if you look at the block of spins, that somehow the number of degrees of freedom that you really have to take into account only scales like the boundaries. That would mean that there's very few relevant degrees of freedom needed to somehow describe this, because all the relevant degrees of freedom would be concentrated around the boundary. And indeed, it turns out that so with some kind of there's been lots of effort in trying to identify that. And indeed, we have been able to prove that in a fairly generic kind of circumstances always, then any other law always holds. So if you look at this kind of block of spins and calculate the entropy, then somehow typically you have an area. So this scales like the length somehow of the boundary and not as the volume. But if you look at, back at these kind of random states, the entropy would always scale like the volume. Okay, because this is exactly there's no distinction between this is a very kind of particular property that if you look at the entropy it scales like the boundary. That means that that's really some kind of very strong notion of locality. If you want to somehow simulate, if you want to come up with some variational method, for example, to simulate these systems, it's enough to have some kind of method that takes into account these local correlations. You don't need these kind of long-range correlations. So the next idea somehow that arose is we try to understand these properties. There's this strong locality. You have this kind of decaying correlation. So let's try to make that a little bit more explicit, and let's just use some kind of very very standard tools of quantum information theory. So we know that, assume that indeed you have a finite correlation, okay? That in the sense that this thing factors. That if you look at rho AB, that this is just equal to rho A times rho B. So let's try to identify somehow what that means. What does it imply? So what properties does this give to this state? So one thing that is really a standard tool. So whenever you have a purification, because you know that the ground state of that system is a purification of rho AB. Okay, you have a pure state, you trace out the part, and you get kind of rho AB. That whenever you have a purification of a state, and you have, of course this is not unique, because you can do a unitary transformation on this block, and then trace out that block, and you'll still get the same kind of rho AB. Now it turns out that all the purifications must be on that form. So whenever you have some kind of a psi 1, that has as a reduced density operator rho AB. So this is a state defined over A, B, and C. Okay, and you have a state psi 2 defined over A, B, C that also gets the same reduced density operator rho AB. Then in this case, it's some kind of rho A tensor rho B. Then if this is true, then it follows that this psi 1 is equal to psi 2 up to a unitary operation on this block in the middle. Okay, so you have rho A, rho B, and rho C in the middle. And you look at all possible purifications of this state, you know that all of them are such that they are related by unitary transformation. But of course, there's a trivial kind of purification of this state, namely something that purifies rho A and C prime, tensor rho B, C prime. Okay, so this is... and of course, this would be pure states. Okay, so what a trivial purification of this state is this one. And but of course, the original purification is the ground state. Okay, so what does this imply? This implies that if you have your system, with rho A, B, and C, that there exists a unitary that you can do on this block of spins that completely disentangles the left from the right. Okay, because that's what you obtain. Because you have these two possible purifications. You know that they are related. Because, and this is just a tensor product. Somehow these would be the spins C prime, and this would be the spins C double prime. But somehow what you have is with this unitary, you're able to completely disentangle the left from the right part. Okay, and of course you can do this in parallel. You have the same thing here. So what you do is also put kind of the same unitary here. You can do the same thing here. Okay, so what this really means is that by doing some kind of local, because this is pretty local, no? This is just in the order of the correlation length in your system. And by doing some kind of local operations, you can completely map your ground state into a product state. Okay, so this is very particular. Okay, so by doing local operations, you completely disentangle your system. And the extent of how far this is related to correlation length, and is also, of course, also related to how much entanglement is there in the system. And because of how you always get something like an area law, you know that there's very few entanglement. Like in one dimension, typically this entropy of this block of spins does not grow anymore when the block becomes bigger, because that's exactly what the area law tells you. And in the case of critical systems, the entropy of this block of spins will grow like the logarithm of the size of the block. But this is still very, very slow. So because in principle it could grow linearly, but no, even for critical systems there's very few entanglements. It means that somehow you don't have to look at big blocks to write this down. No, anyway, so this is the way somehow that's the way people incorporate information here. You look at spin systems. Okay, so we have this. So let's now try to formalize this. Now we know that somehow there will always exist some unitary such that you can disentangle, and this is always approximate. So let's try to write down a wave function, somehow the class of wave functions that has a property that you can do this. Okay, and this is a subclass of the so-called matrix product space. Okay, and
can I still ask a question?
Yes.
In a correlation function, the case exponentially, and you made the point that still the states are not product states. Now, outside the correlation function, you say you can make product state.
Up to this kind of epsilon that is exponentially small.
So then the correlation function does not change.
Of course.
So the decay of the correlation is still the same as before.
No, that's not true. So because you did.
So how does it change it?
Of course, everything that you in this block within this block you do what you want, so you can change. There is no correlation like basically anymore within this block. No? But what you have is so you do this unitary here, you do this unitary here, and what you get is really blocks here. Okay, so this block at the end is completely disentangled from this block. It's completely disentangled from, but within this block you still have some kind of lots of entanglement.
Yeah, but the correlation length now between the blocks or the correlation function between the blocks would be zero.
Yes. This would be completely zero. But within this block it would not be zero. Okay, but between this block and this block it would be zero. But this is only approximate, of course. It's up to epsilon. Okay, and that's why somehow if you can do this exactly, this would be a very So the variational classes that I will write down now that somehow exhibit this property is also only up to epsilon. So they are richer. So they're rather close to somehow they are more physical than the class of states that you can write down like this. But still, this is the picture you have to have in mind that there is kind of a very strong notion of locality there, and you see that the complexity of writing down this wave function is not exponentially anymore in the number of qubits. Okay, because the only thing you have to specify is basically what is this unitary that I have to do to implement, and what is this kind of state that I get here on something in the order of the correlation length of qubits. Okay, so
you
so
make the block as small as you like.
No, this block has to be. Of course, this will be dependent on the exact state that you have. So you have to. This block has to be long enough such that somehow the correlation between the two extremes of the block are very small. But still, this is the kind of variational class that I will present that somehow exhibits some features like this will be richer and it will not be, it will go beyond that. But somehow the reason that it is possible to have an efficient representation of ground states, that it's possible to go from this exponential complexity to some kind of a lower complexity, this is the intuition why it's possible. That somehow there is a method of disentangling these ground states.
You mentioned the point. Critical systems. In the case of critical systems, say metals or where you have no gap.
Yes.
I mean, the representation of the matrix product space of those systems is not going to.
No, but still, you have even if you have power law decay of correlation, you give me an epsilon. At the end, if you want to simulate the systems, the game is like this. You say, I want to know this kind of expectation value up to error epsilon. Okay, you specify this epsilon. Then for this given epsilon, there will be a length of the block such that some of the correlations that go beyond this block are kind of irrelevant. Okay, because even with power law, power law is still very fast. And then somehow this will define how big does this block have to be. And then you somehow you disentangle and then you just simulate within this block. But and it turns out indeed that this variational class that I will show you that is kind of based on these methods that. And this variational class is able to represent critical systems at polynomial cost. So if you specify, you can prove that if you take your kind of like a Heisenberg system that is critical, or an Ising model in critical or transverse field, and you specify your error epsilon, you say I want to calculate this observable up to precision epsilon, then somehow the number of parameters you will need within this matrix product state to represent this ground state up to this other epsilon will only be scaled polynomially with the number of qubits and also polynomially in the error. So that means that you have really come down from this exponential kind of big Hilbert space, the exponential complexity of diagonalizing your Hamiltonian exactly to some kind of a polynomial complexity. So even in the case of critical systems.
But this property is just, I mean, this fact is just valid for the energy only or for everything?
For everything.
Yeah, but the correlations are not going to be well represented.
No, they are. No. But that's we go beyond that picture. Okay, in this matrix plot state, you go beyond that picture. It's not you have correlations that extend over everything. Yeah. So what
we have more correlations that, but then I'm confused. You said you disentangle basically. You make
almost yeah. You almost disentangle. There's always this error epsilon, no?
Yeah, and you take care of that epsilon, so you know what you actually want.
No, so what I will do is write down the class of states that can exactly be written like this, okay? And this will be the kind of states that you can create by doing a unitary here, unitary there, and so further. Now it turns out that somehow within that kind of if you look at the kind of class of states, it's trivial generalization by not just allowing unitaries, but you just allow any maps there. And when you have this kind of non-unitaries but any map, then these states can have correlations that go arbitrarily fast, but always decay exponentially. Okay, and then the number of parameters somehow you have in these states will determine how far. With these methods, you will always be able to simulate finite size systems. Okay, and even with any kind of power law decay, you can always model by a sum of many exponentials. And it turns out that the number of exponentials, because all these systems decay exponentially somehow, what the number of exponentials you need to simulate the power law is only linear in the system size. Okay, but these are kind of very technical details. It's just you can prove that the complexity of simulating critical systems using this kind of matrix product states is polynomial in the number of states you have and not exponential. Do I have to stop at 6?
Yeah, you started about 10 past 5, so I think 1 hour is the other time.
So somehow this gives us some insights into what is the nature of these systems? What is the nature of this? How does this kind of useful manifold look like? What are the basic properties? And so now it's a bit technical to go from this kind of picture to the picture of matrix product states or of perhaps somehow the states that we propose. And it turns out that you can out of these kind of conditions you can come up with a good guess. How do generic ground states look like? And the basic picture is a picture that was introduced by Ekiel, the Affleck, Kennedy, Leap, and Tazaki, and it's called Ekiel T. And it's a generalization of that picture. But anyway, so what they do is say, if you, for example, have a spin 1/2 system, what they say, effectively, these spin 1/2s, you can understand that as consisting out of two virtual degrees of freedom that are much larger than the spin 1/2. So you have a D-level system here, which is D, which can be big. And this is a D-level, and somehow what you have here is a maximally entangled state between two D-level systems. So this kind of state, this trivial state, would be written as something like this, I is equal to 1 to D. So and this exactly the state somehow shows us. The goal of this state is somehow to create very strong correlations between these neighbors. And this is what you want. No? This is one of the defining properties of ground states, namely that they have extremal local properties. So they must have very strong local correlations. And that's what this kind of state does. And this kind of so this is one state, this is another state, and they don't talk to each other. But somehow what these people, AKLT, they somehow show is that if you project this, somehow you project a d squared dimensional Hilbert space to a two-dimensional Hilbert space. Anyway, the AKLT people, they didn't look at this. They just found out of one example where these were spin 1/2 systems and this was a spin 1 system. But anyway, the picture is very similar. So what you do is just project this d squared dimensional system to a two-dimensional system. And so what are the properties that, so of course there are many parameters here, because we have 2 × d² parameters for this map. It turns out that all these states, so you have a map here, you do the same kind of thing. So what turns out is that what is very useful in this parameterization is that it automatically gives you a parameterization of transition invariant states. And this is very hard in general to come up with the kind of, how do we parameterize transition invariant states? And this is the reason that this is also it's very hard is due to this monogamy of entanglement. But if you represent your state like this, it is transition invariant by construction, because somehow you start with maximally entangled states, just bipartite entangled states. This is the kind of things we understand in quantum information here. And then you just locally project this state is transition invariant by construction. And it turns out that this class of states is exactly the kind of states you need to this class of states that you can obtain from disentangling these different regions from each other. All these states can exactly be represented as states like that. But these states are even richer. You can do more than that. And what is very intriguing is that somehow all the renormalization group methods that have been developed in the context of one-dimensional spin chains. Okay, and this is I'm talking both of the numerical renormalization group methods of Wilson and the so-called DMRG methods of Steve White. So the numerical renormalization group methods of Wilson were the ones in which he somehow was able to solve the Kondo numerically kind of solve the Kondo problem. And the reason that he could do that is basically that you have this kind of impurity that scatters only S waves. And because it only scatters S waves, he was able to map this problem into a one-dimensional spin chain problem. And then this one-dimensional spin chain problem, he solved using some kind of a method, some kind of a normalization group method. No, it turns out that you can reinterpret exactly what you did as a variational method within this class of states. Now, the DMRG method can also be reinterpreted as a kind of a variational method within this class of states. And DMRG is well known to be somehow basically exact. So take any kind of Hamiltonian in one dimension, the Heisenberg or critical or whatever, and then this is a numerical kind of method that basically gives you with machine precision that the ground state energy can calculate correlation, can do anything with it. But it's very limited. It's limited to one dimension. But still, so all these methods that are very extremely successful, all variational methods within this class of states, that of course have exactly these properties that we are looking at. And so the big challenge, however, in all these kind of simulation methods and the simulation was how do you extend these methods to 2D? But once you have this picture in mind, it is basically completely trivial. What you do is just add more singlets. Okay, so you just start drawing more and more. Okay. And you draw more singlets, and what you get is a 2D lattice. Okay, and somehow, so this is kind of a picture that you have now that, okay, the variational states that we need to use in higher dimensions would be of this form. What you have this kind of big state that consists out of locally projecting out singlets. And if you, for example, calculate the area, the entropy of a block of spins in this case, what you will see is that this kind of, if you would calculate the entropy of this block, basically the entropy of that block will scale as the number of bonds that you cut. And that means that by construction, all these methods will indeed obey this area laws that you want to see. So these ground states obey area laws, these states will obey area laws by construction. And indeed, Matthew Hastings has recently been able to prove that indeed any ground state of any local Hamiltonian will have an efficient representation as one of these states. With the D somehow, because D is of course the number of the parameter that controls how many parameters do you have within this variational class. And this D only scales polynomially in the number of spins. So it means that somehow basically using these methods we have been able to identify this relevant manifold. And so the next thing to do is to turn this into a variational method and start doing numerics. So we are currently developing this. It's not straightforward because it involves lots of the results that we have are very promising, and it turns out that somehow you can really simulate, for example, Heisenberg model on the Kagome lattice and all this you can use these methods to do that. And the holy grail is of course that we want to simulate the Hubbert model, okay, the Hubbert model in 2D. And somehow we have a guarantee that within this variational class that we are looking, the ground state of this Hubbert model will be there will be a good representation using these kind of states. So it's really more than an ad hoc method. We can prove that all the states, all the ground states that you're interested in, are always of that sort. Just as a side remark, so you have this class of states. So let's now look back somehow and get some idea of, is it really true that somehow, let us find interesting examples of these states. But it turns out that, for example, these historic code states that were talked about in the previous session, or also all these kind of models that exhibit topological quantum order of cycles and when, all of these models have an exact representation in terms of these kind of class of states, where this D is only equal to 2. So it's really, they are really the simplest possible states within this class. So this kind of class of states is indeed rich enough to take into account to describe topological quantum order. You can also have critical systems. So critical systems in two dimensions are well described by this. You can have the cluster states. So these kind of cluster states are a very interesting state in the sense that they, if you would be able to create one of those states, you would be able to do universal quantum computation just by doing local measurements on the qubits. These cluster states are also states like this with d is equal to 2. So it's pretty already for d is equal to 2, for the kind of lowest level, because this is of course a hierarchy of states. Okay, so we have this parameter d that controls somehow how many parameters do we have in this class. And already for the lowest states in this hierarchy, it's very rich. If you take d is equal to 1, then this is equivalent to kind of a mean field state. There would be no entanglement at all. D is equal to 2 already contains all this class of states. If you go to d equal to 3, you have more. If you would go to d is equal to basically 2 to the n, with n the number of spins, you would have every state. So every state has a representation like this, but for this, you would have to take this d extremely large. Okay, so I think I have to stop here. So I can I plan somehow to talk a little bit about the simulation or also about what things you can do with these things like simulating random systems and all this, but I will do that in private conversations if people are interested. Okay, thanks for your attention.
In 1D, it's kind of obvious to see how you use these. If you give me like the local operators, it's obvious how you would compute correlation functions. But do you know how to do it in 2D?
Yeah, so so basically to calculate these correlation functions, what you have to do is to contract the tensor network.
Yeah.
Okay, and 1D, basically the way you calculate correlation functions by it amounts to multiplying matrices with each other, and that's why these states are called matrix product states. Okay, in two dimensions, the situation is harder. Okay, so in two dimensions, what you have to do instead of multiplying matrices, you have to contract the tensor network. Okay, and of course, one of the first things we did is try to work out what is the computational complexity of contracting a general tensor network, and you can prove that it's sharp p. Okay, so this is a very big problem. This is even harder than QMA. Okay, so this is an impossible problem. But of course, in practice, what we have is translation invariant systems, or systems with really some kind of lots of symmetries, and for these systems, we have methods that deal with this, that effectively contract these tensor networks up to negligible error. So we can control the error by which you contract. And if you would give me an instance of a problem that would be very hard, and we start contracting this, we would see that it's a hard problem. Okay, but in practice, for reasonable models that are, for example, translation invariant, we have very efficient procedures for contracting this. Because if you... To give you some kind of an idea of how this works, if you contract this tensor network, basically it's very similar to the classical problem of calculating the partition function of a two-dimensional classical spin model. Mm-hmm. And the way you do that is by calculating somehow the largest eigenvalue of transfer matrix. And this is the way you solve the Ising model. Now, if you look at this transfer matrix, it is translation invariant. And finding the largest eigenvalue of a transfer matrix is basically the equivalent problem as finding the lowest energy state of a one-dimensional quantum spin system. Okay, it has the same properties, it has the same complexity, it has these kind of eigenstates have all these properties that obey an area law and all this. But we know how to do that. We know how to calculate this kind of largest eigenvector, and we know that it's well represented by a matrix product state. And therefore, somehow we can contract these things, and we have a guarantee that it works. But indeed, so all the detail, it's at the end, if you work this out and you want to program it, it's much more complicated than it is. But somehow, I think that the really interesting statement that we can make is that we have identified the manifold of ground states. Okay, so we.
But you can also compute things efficiently.
Yes.
But not if it was a random system.
No, if it's a random system, there's no hope. Yes. But nature itself will not find the ground state in the, if you have a spin glass, so it is fine.
Can I just inject a whole note of demographics concerning the importance or lack of entanglement in nature, in particular in metaphysics? It seems to me that at least until now, the three most spectacular phenomena which have been realized in condensed matter physics are first superfluidity, secondly superconductivity, and thirdly fraction of one Hall effect. In the case of superfluidity, we get a spectacularly good qualitative explanation of the phenomenon using the Gross-Podolsky theory, which is completely unentangled.
Yes.
And in the case of superconductivity and the fraction of one Hall effect, sure, there's entanglement there, but it's very, very, very simple example of entanglement at the two-particle level. So I'm not sure that, at least in these cases, nature really puts that much weight on entanglement.
No, but the Laughlin state is pretty entangled, no?
It's just two-body.
No, but two-body, whenever you have two-body entanglement, everything has to. If one is entangled with two and two is entangled with three, somehow one is entangled with three and one is entangled with two and three, and it's impossible.
Well, yeah, it's very simple structure.
I'm not too familiar with Laughlin wavelengths, but I think there's lots of entanglement in there. But indeed, so I agree. For most systems, like in quantum chemistry, it is sufficient to just look at these kind of mean field states. Or superconductivity are basically mean field states. But I think that the really interesting new physics, that because at the end we want to detect new physics, and the new physics, the new kind of phases of matter will be the ones that exhibit kind of new types of entanglement, and this is why you're interested in it. But I agree. So the kind of typical states that will occur in nature, they don't exhibit lots of time.
Things could be very different in the future.
Yes, let's hope so.
Yeah, actually, I think in many cases of condensed matter physics, you do have entanglements. Say, for example, you have a JST particles, but after all the JST particle behaves like free particles.
Yeah. So in other words, in some sense, these. If you think about something in matter for nuclear, sure, you do have a certain degree of entanglement, but in some sense the topology of the many body wave function is still very much the same as it is for free from the get.
Okay, further questions or remarks?
Yes.
Yeah, just one question. What is the ground state now in the power on?
We'll tell you next week. Or next year.
But I mean, how close are you?
No. So the problem with fermions is first of all, these methods somehow are really, we made them up, and somehow all these properties are basically easily proven for spin systems. Now, of course, we would like to go to fermionic systems, and we worked out the mapping. How you map? How can you map kind of fermionic system to spin systems? And you can do that, but you have to add some kind of additional degrees of freedom. Because at the end, all these methods only work because you have local Hamiltonians. So what you want to do is if you have, start with the Hubbert model, you want to map this Hubbert model to a local spin model that has exactly the same kind of ground state energy and ground state features than the original model. But to do that, somehow within this mapping, what we have to do is to double the number of degrees of freedom. So for every kind of fermion, you have to, every fermion you map to two qubits. Now, in the Hubbert model, what you have is, of course, two fermions at every side. Okay, so you have to map these two fermions to four qubits. So what you have is really 16-level systems. So that means that in this kind of Hamiltonian you want to diagonalize, it's indeed a local Hamiltonian, but it has 16, the local kind of dimension is 16, is 16. And this is still way out of what we can do numerically. So the problem is just the scaling. We probably need some kind of a supercomputer, and with that we could do it, yes, but we don't have. So
this result of the Hastings that you quoted, that the capital V grows at worst polynomial. Could you clarify this whole thing? What conditions?
Yeah, I'm not. I'm myself. That's not very clear to me. What he that's his claim, and it could also be that it's sub-exponential, that it's some kind of a d to the that it's that it's super polynomial, but still sub-exponential. So he's not very clear in that. But
this is irrespective, at least allegedly, of the spatial dimensionality.
Yes.
And the whether there's a gap or not.
Yeah, so what he does is basically prove that the Gibbs state at any temperature can be well represented by one, because you can generalize all these states to mixed states. And it turns out that for Gibbs states it's much simpler to do the whole analysis, and that's why he was able to prove these things. Because with the Gibbs state somehow there is, for example, in the case of these area laws, at finite temperature you always get an exact area law. You don't have these logarithmic corrections, you can prove that. And so for Gibbs states everything works out fine, and that's why he proved that if you can every local Hamiltonian, that if you look at a Gibbs state even at very low temperature, it has a good representation as one of these states.
But I guess the polynomial growth must depend on the spatial dimensionality.
Yes, sure. So in the case of certainly in one dimension it's polynomial.
Okay.
So in two dimensions, I'm not so sure, but it could be something like exponential of log of n squared or something like that. So it could be something like that, but I'm not. Okay, so this is. So, and this would be the dimension here, the dimension of your system. So I think what he gets is some kind of. But this is really another part, and he claims that he can still much improve on that. So these are kind of.
So, strictly speaking, polynomial only in one dimension, the sub exponent.
Yes. Yeah. But somehow what you have to realize also is that the higher the dimensions, the better these methods should work, okay? Because of this monogamy of entanglement. So the higher the dimension, the less entanglement there can be in the system.
But except an infinite dimension, can't you have anything?
An infinite dimension, and if you have a Hamiltonian, then you don't. Then its mean field is exact. If it's symmetric, it's symmetric, of course. If you have the same Hamiltonian in the x and y and z and infinity direction.
Oh, well, we use. Oh, okay, I see. Yeah. Okay.
Then, yeah.
The question over there?
I would like to ask a question now relating to what Tony said before about the diffraction of quantum particle. So, since I heard in another talk that you can represent, some at least roughly states in terms of matrix product states. Can you say something about that?
But I think this is work of Jose Ignacio, but I don't think this is an efficient representation. It's an exponential. I don't think this is an efficient representation.
We have asked for the entropies, so you know that if it's a very large parameter, it's exponentially large.
Yeah, but maybe you can choose another kind of, you can do a change of basis in which there's not.
If the change of basis should be non-local.
Yes. Yeah, but it's not clear. I don't think it's understood. Well, how
so
much
it's
time
not understood
it.
That you have an efficient matrix product representation.
No, you do have a matrix product state. The size of the matrix is exponential.
Well, that's what I mean, an efficient representation.
No, so I don't. It's not known. But this is because there's kind of, so what you do with this method, it's kind of you push. It doesn't really fit this spin system kind of picture.
Say if you knew a good representation for a given model, and you change this model. So, the representation change completely. Say if I start from a Hubbard model with one such interaction, and then I add next nearest neighbor interactions or something, would that mean that I would have to look for a new way to represent the?
I don't know. If you could always somehow adiabatically, so you try to find the balance of one, and then you adiabatically somehow change the parameter, and you change your state a little bit. And if these two states are in the same phase, this should work. But if they're in a different phase, of course, you would have problems. Could start from scratch again, I know. But I'm somehow, I have to excuse somehow that at the end of the talk I was very kind of oligocentric, in the sense that there's much other work that has been done. Like Giffrey Vidal has very interesting work on how to represent kind of critical systems how you get. So it's I was at the end in this last in this blackboard at the end what I wrote down was these matrix proxies, these steps. But there's other work that is interesting somehow. There's other representations that. So I think this is a complete representation, but it's probably too much. That not all these states are therefore kind of guaranteed to be physical, although they are all guaranteed to be ground states of some local model. But there's all that kind of work, mainly of Kiefer-Vidal, that is very interesting in trying to characterize, for example, what is the class of, what would be a good representation of critical systems. And then there's also lots of other work that has been done in trying to identify what is the, how do you quantify somehow the entanglement is there. There's lots of interest in this, in trying what is the kind of nature of entanglement that physical states, like low energy states, have. And there's, and I'm sure there's lots of more new things to discover.
Okay, that sounds like a very interesting.